you, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Ring Respect Radio right here on the Video Bros Network, right on YouTube. If you haven't done so already in the past, we ask you to go ahead and click the subscribe button down below and hit that notification bell. Anytime we release new material here on Ring Respect, you'll be the first to know it. You can also catch Ring Respect Radio now through Backbreaker Media's channels, both on Podbean and YouTube. So if you haven't checked us out here, you can always check us out there. And make sure to go and like and subscribe over on both Podbean and YouTube, where you can check out all the greatest in wrestling podcasts here in Western Canada. Today on the show, though, we are going to be talking about tag team wrestling. And speaking of tag teams, I'm here, as always, with my video bro, the man with the angelic voice. He is Papa Smokes. How are you, Papa Smokes?
I'm doing great, Munson. Hey, yo, to all the wrestling people out there.
So, Papa Smokes, tag team wrestling, that's going to be the subject of today's topic. And the reason being, unfortunately, just recently at the end of September, the world was robbed of another great legend in the wrestling business, Road Warrior Animal, untimely passing.
Yeah, what a terrible shock and bad news for the entire wrestling world. And only 60 years old, too. A surprise. We had seen clips and pictures of Joe Laurinaitis back from the previous months and previous years. I always thought he looked good and he looked healthy. And yeah, just a shock to find him dead at age 60.
The subject of today's thing, we're going to get into talking about tag team wrestling, the history of some tag teams in the industry, some of the greatest of all time. But you can't talk about the greatest without talking about the Road Warriors, though, can you, Papa Smokes?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They were one of the tag teams that made an indelible mark on the wrestling business. And Laurinaitis and Hegstrand, or Animal and Hawk, were just unforgettable characters and unforgettable wrestlers, and we'll never probably see another tag team like them in professional wrestling.
Probably not, and you'll probably be able to help me out a little bit more with the history on this one, but if I'm not mistaken, it was Paul Ellering that came up the original idea for the Road Warriors gimmick itself. He was looking to create a stable of sorts in Georgia Championship Wrestling called the Legion of Doom, which inevitably gave their name in the WWF, WWE later on. But he came up with the ideas of Hawk and Animal being these road warriors, these bikers that came out. And that's where the face paint started kicking in and everything like that. And the gimmick kind of unfolded with manager Paul Ellering at the time.
Yeah. I think it started as Animal as a singles wrestler at first. And I don't know if you've seen some of those original matches where they debuted him in Georgia Championship Wrestling. We've talked about and watched that great wrestling show from the 80s, which basically became WCW afterwards. But those early matches where they didn't quite have the presentation figured out yet, and Animal's got wearing the Daisy Duke denim shorts with the little boots on and the denim vest and everything. Clearly the look needed a little bit of work, but once they got Hawk on board and decided on the kind of look from the movie The Road Warrior, with the face paint and everything, it was a gimmick that got a lot of attention, and it got everybody's attention at that time.
So very well-rounded out team. They managed to really kind of conquer the world of professional wrestling. And we're not talking just about the North American market. These guys traveled everywhere in the world. Four-time NWA National Tag Team Champions. They were the AWA World Tag Team Champions on top of a couple runs at the WWF as the Tag Team Champions over there. And I believe, if I was reading correctly, some of the Tag Team Championships they held within the NWA are the ones that inevitably became known as the WCW Tag Team Champions. So even though on record they never were WCW Tag Team Champions, they did hold the belts that were eventually known as those titles.
Yeah, and by the same token, I think one of the only other Triple Crown champions like that were Team 3D or the Dudley Boys. I guess they have tag team titles, and AWA wouldn't have been around by that time, but all the major federations as well. There might be one or two other Triple Crown champs, but it hasn't happened very often, and the Warriors were the first and most explosive to do it.
Yeah, I think it's times have changed a little bit now. I think they make a bigger deal out of teams, though, and they tend to win the ones in New Japan as well as the North American Championships and everything. But you're right about the Triple Crown. It was almost an impossible feat for teams back in the day to ever get there. But if any team was ever going to do it, the Road Warriors were by far the one team that needed to and should be doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. And we're talking about their presentation. I mean, they're one of those teams that was the booking was simple for them because their work had already been done before any match would start. Just in the way they looked, their gigantic and huge, powerful bodies. There were a few strong men in wrestling before that, but when these two came up, they really, really changed the game for that. And then you saw a lot more muscle guys after that. But also, yeah, just in their appearance, their general presentation, they would be booked as squashers, so to speak. They would come in, rush the ring, beat the opponents, and always a short match with their opponents getting little or no offense in. So, I mean, that sort of gimmick worked perfectly for the booking in all those companies. And this was another thing, too, that with booking like that, they didn't get the experience that a lot of wrestlers have of bumping and taking offensive moves from their opponents, because a lot of their matches were squash matches. So Hawk and Animal had to learn slowly as they went along, because they never were getting beat. They were never getting beaten up in their matches or on the defensive kind of thing. So they were a work in progress. They certainly weren't the best workers of any tag team in terms of technical wrestling or anything like that. But they had that locomotive freight train kind of booking that just put them right to the top in any company they were in. And quite frankly, the fans just couldn't get enough of it.
And rightfully so. It almost makes me believe that then later on, when Paul Ellering, more recently, I guess, in NXT, took over the team of the Authors of Pain, it really kind of, for me, had that old school feel of the original Road Warriors to it. They weren't necessarily the fastest or, you know, best workers inside the ring, but that feel of the two big powerhouses coming in and Paul Ellering being able to sell them as two big powerhouses, I think really inevitably made them a team to watch at the time. And the second they took that Paul Ellering element out from the AOP was the downfall of them as a tag team. Lucky enough, back in the day of the Road Warriors, that wasn't the case. You didn't pull managers from guys immediately after putting them together. You allowed that to gel and mold and get to work with each other for many years to understand each other and get to work on a better level together.
Yeah, I think the AOP also were kind of challenged in the area of promos. So then it's a good idea for them to have a manager by their side, especially a brain like Paul Ellering, always a good promo, always an intelligent guy. But I like the way he worked with Hawk and Animal too, because he could carry some of the promo for them, but they were also pretty good in their rough way too. All of their promos as a team would feature all three of them speaking. And as we know, Hawk has some very memorable lines, including "What a Rush" and a few other things. They had the ability to speak to the fans too, and that got them over as well.
I want to tell a little bit of a story, because we like going back on our own personal lives and stuff like that and everything, and memories. And I remember as a little kid, I've told you many times before, being a WWF fan as a child. I remember seeing the Legion of Doom back in the time when they were running there, when they were tag team champions over there. And I really recall this, going to Lawson Heights Mall in Saskatoon as a kid, and they had this store, which I believe is now an insurance company or something in that location. But in the day, they had this store that sold video games and everything. And I remember seeing this box for this Nintendo game, and it was a wrestling game that I had never witnessed before, because the ones I was personally familiar with were the ones that were labeled with the WWF stuff. Was not familiar with anything outside their own company at the time. And I remember seeing this picture on the front cover, and I'm like, I swear that's Hawk and Animal of the Legion of Doom. But everything I kept reading on this kept saying about the Road Warriors, and I was so unfamiliar with them outside of that WWF aspect that I did not understand that these were the same guys just under the name that they did outside of what I was used to growing up. And reading into this whole thing kind of brought up that memory for me of seeing that game that one day. And that was, I think, the first time that I started to realize as a really young kid, I'm talking about 6, 7 years old, that there was wrestling outside of the wrestling I was exposed to.
Yeah, yeah, that must have been an eye-opener. Hey, Munson, I have a similar story like that, too. I remember I'm a bit older than you, Munson, so I was playing some of my video games in the stand-up arcades, you know, popping quarters in and such. And I remember there was a game called Wrestling Slam or something to that effect, and it was a Japanese game, very early 80s awkward kind of a video game, but it was the only wrestling game that they had, and I wanted to play that. And they had takeoffs on some of the North American stars that had interesting characters and such. The player one that you controlled was called Kid Dynamite, and was clearly based on Dynamite Kid as a face in Japan. And then one of your opponents was Power Warrior, and it was clearly Animal from the Road Warriors. And I remember thinking, wow, like, these guys are getting really big because now they're in a video game. They obviously don't have the rights to the real name, but I remember noting that too, to think that, wow, they're getting in big Japanese video games now too.
Well, speaking of the 1980s and Japanese wrestling scene, as you brought that up, actually, Animal, who we speak of, spent about 5 years over in Japan after getting out of the North American market from about 1985 to 1990, making a name over there in both All Japan Pro Wrestling and some appearances in New Japan Pro Wrestling during that five-year span.
Yeah, yeah. Are you talking about Hawk? I think it might have been Hawk, because once the LOD broke up in WWE, he went over and formed a similar tag team to the Road Warriors with that Kensuke Sasaki, I think, who's quite a huge muscular dude over there, and he got the makeup on it. They each took different partners for a little while after the team was dissolving, and never, of course, with even a fraction of the same success and respect as the Road Warriors had, but with their various pairings. We saw what the WWE did with them too, putting the ventriloquist dummy as one of their sidekicks, and having Tammy Sitch or Sonny managing them and such. It just, they never really got over in the WWE, and I think it was partly because of what we were talking about before with that booking that pushed them hard like a freight train kind of thing. Vince didn't want to give them that in WWE, so they were they didn't go on a winning streak or anything like that, and I don't think they looked invulnerable to the fans, and they just were booked differently, and it wasn't booked to their strengths. I think it was booked to their weaknesses, and I mean, they had their popularity there, but they weren't they never made nearly the splash in WWE that they did in the rest of the country and the world, for that matter.
Yeah. And I believe when you were mentioning Hawk going over there, their run in WWE actually lasted from 1990 to 1992 before that split when Hawk left. Okay. Originally, and Animal stayed with the WWE as a competitor. From 85 to 90 was when they spent the time in All Japan and New Japan prior to being signed by Vince McMahon and the WWE. Okay. So yeah, just an interesting fact there that the time was spent. And then you mentioned about taking on different partners, and I had to bring this up because I remember when it happened, it was stupid as hell, but Animal and Heidenreich as the WWE Tag Team Champions. I mean, I like Animal. I mean, I didn't dislike Heidenreich as much as everybody else. I mean, he was kind of garbage in the ring, but I mean, he was all right for the most part. Yeah. Plus, I liked his fucking poetry personally.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that speaks to their history as a team. I mean, you could always kind of tell that Animal was the anchor that kind of held the team together, and Hawk was the kind of loose cannon. We know that Animal was a more straight edge in his private life, and Hawk simply a wild man for partying and drugs and alcohol and all kinds of crazy behavior. And I think Animal was the guy that he kept the band together for a long time there, and I mean, Hawk was spitting in McMahon's face, and I think he slapped McMahon's face and quit a couple of times and took off without notice, and they had to cancel their bookings. And Hawk was a loose cannon. I love him, but he didn't care sometimes about what happened. And Animal was the guy trying to keep it together. And if he had to have Heidenreich or Draws or whoever as his partner, and then he came back, his last run in WWE was just, it was like back to the beginning. He was just the Road Warrior as a single again. It's kind of weird the way things come around again. But yeah, he always had his personal life and the business life together quite a lot more than Hawk did, and he helped keep that team going for a long time. I think sometimes hoping for a reunion so they could keep it going, and they did have a few too, but Hawk was just gonna do his own thing no matter what.
And then you talk about the Road Warriors, inducted into pretty much every Hall of Fame you can think of in professional wrestling. I mean, obviously the WWE Hall of Fame, but they've also been inducted into every other major wrestling Hall of Fame that you can think of, including, I found this one quite interesting, the Quebec Wrestling Hall of Fame right here in Canada. Wow. The Road Warriors also inducted into that back in the late 2000s there as well, too. So a lot of accolades, not just with championships, but to where they've been inducted into as Hall of Famers as well, too. And again, we can't stress enough how these guys were two of the absolute best inside that ring. And like you've said, Animal might have been the one that held it together, but something just clicked with them as a tag team. There were two guys that, I don't know if individually on their own, they were ever two guys we were going to get behind in an accelerated top of the card type team or anything, or sorry, top of the card individual wrestlers or anything like that. But as a team, there was just something magic that worked between those two guys, that it was sold well. It didn't matter where they went, you were glued to them. I remember watching as a kid, watching those Legion of Doom matches, and even though they weren't booked the same as they were everywhere else, I still was wildly behind that whole gimmick. I liked them. I liked that they were two big brutish type guys, and I felt like when they got inside the ring, that it didn't matter if they were going up against, you know, other big guys. I felt like they were going to hold their own in there. I didn't feel like these guys were going to go in there and get crushed by the natural disasters or somebody like that along the path.
Yeah. I'll share a childhood memory of Road Warriors too. I have talked on this podcast before about being a teenager in Winnipeg and being taken to the matches by my dad and brother, and going with friends sometimes to the Vern Gagne's AWA. And when the Road Warriors made their run in AWA, it was electrifying for the young wrestling fan. I was going crazy. But anyway, they had a long angle that was going on between Sheik Adnan El Casey, and this was their Sheik character. He had a little army or faction going, which included Bruiser Brody, and they had kicked Jerry Blackwell or Crusher Blackwell out of their faction, and then there was going to be a big blow off match of Bruiser Brody versus Jerry Blackwell in the cage. They took this match on tour for sure, but one of the places that it was going to be was Winnipeg. And my brother and I were excited for this match for so long. It was going to be, while we loved Brody, we knew he was a huge star throughout the world. And when we got to the show, the main event got changed because Brody no-showed, which we all know that he was notorious for doing, holding up promoters sometimes, saying, well, you got to pay me double that now or I'm not going to appear on your show tonight, and then you're going to lose money in the long run. He did stuff like that, and we know what happened at the end there. But at any rate, we were disappointed that Brody wasn't going to be there, so the Sheik came out and purchased the services from Paul Ellering of a Road Warrior. He chose Hawk, and Hawk wrestled Blackwell in this blow-off cage match, which, like I say, we were all looking forward to. Was the culmination of an almost year-long feud, and when Brody no-showed, it was disappointing. But I remember thinking, wow, Hawk got in there, like, he probably wasn't intending to do that match when he showed up here today and did a real good job of it. Lots of blood, lots of crazy. Was in one of those old wire link cages, one of the schoolyard fence kind of cages where you're so violent and raking each other's foreheads across that, and lots of juice. And wow, I still remember that as such a great match.
would have been fun to be able to see live. And unfortunately, you know, fans of nowadays are not going to get the opportunity to experience either one, because we have lost both Hawk and Animal over the years. Unfortunately, the Road Warriors, the Legion of Doom, however you remember them, no longer with us, and that's unfortunate. But it's a good thing that we've got old tapes, old YouTube videos and stuff like that, that everything at our disposal to go back and watch a lot of these guys. And you know what, in my opinion, a lot of young people in the business, or young people getting into the business, should look at, you know, any of these old guys and look at some of the stuff they did. And we're not saying you have to go back and do exactly what they did, but we were talking before the show went live on the air here today, Pop Smokes, and I was mentioning that you could learn a lot. I've gone back and watched a lot of this old stuff that I hadn't seen from the past, and there's things that I take from it and go, man, if you took this and put a new fresh spin on it with the modern twist, you could really make something of it. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more in depth of other teams, like, and I'm going to mention them right now. FTR will get mentioned later in the show. And there's a team that, you know, has gone and done stuff like that. They've looked back on old tapes. They've gone and reinvented that old style in a new way that it's got people's attention in the modern eras. So there is opportunity for young people getting into this business to go back, watch a lot of this old wrestling from the Road Warriors or any of these other guys that we're mentioning here on Ring Respect all the time, and really take from what they set in the path here for you. There's a lot to learn, and you can do it by just checking out a lot of this stuff right here on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah, it's all there too, and you don't have to take it just as it is, but everything can be given a particular spin. Everything can be modernized, and there's a lot of good ideas out there, but just the way time goes, a lot of people are stuck in the period of 2000 to 2020 kind of thing, of the more modern era, and that stuff is all very derivative of just more modern wrestling matches, and I think a lot of the great artistry of it is lost to the past, and I find it kind of puzzling sometimes, because like I say, it's all out there, but it does take work to watch. You know, where do you start? Because there's, I mean, millions and zillions of hours of old wrestling out there to be watched. But in terms of tag teams, I mean, as we've seen from Cash and Dax in FTR, they're very interested in the golden time of tag team professional wrestling, which would be the 80s in Jim Crockett Promotions. You remember the tag team tournament, the Crockett Cup, was brought all of the best tag teams to the board. They would have 25, 26 tag teams in a huge tournament. And it didn't get any better than that. I still say that a lot of the best innovations were made in the southern U.S. In terms of tag team psychology and all that, and to have participated as the Road Warriors and a few other teams that we still know now, is to have participated in the Crockett Cup, you've really risen to the top of your profession, and that's why FTR watch all that stuff, is because they're a throwback team. And to me, it's no surprise that their popularity and success today.
Definitely. So we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about them and a lot of other tag teams throughout the years, going dating back to some of the early teams that we both grew up on, and also talking about some of the modern ones, which we'll take a little bit of a look into what works about the modern guys and what could be done a little bit better possibly as well, too. Kind of take a look at a little bit of the history of professional wrestling. Before we even get into some of the teams, though, Papa Smokes, you know, watching a lot of the modern day wrestling and stuff like that makes me wonder if fans nowadays even understand what the full rules of tag team wrestling even were. You see a lot of now that, you know, they've changed the rule with the tag itself. Like, to me, it always was growing up, that tag had to be two guys walking up to each other. You're clapping the hand to make a proper tag inside that ring. And now it seems like nobody has to hold a tag rope. They can be just about anywhere on that apron, and you can clap any part of the body, even if it's a blind tag. Like, you see guys clapping each other across the back, and to me, that's not an official tag, because that's not what I grew up on personally.
Yeah, yeah, and I think they added some of those tags like that just to provide a little bit of suspense in the match, or they wanted tags to happen where the legal man in the ring doesn't realize he's been tagged, and sometimes that causes a tension between the tag team partners. But I got to agree with you there. I think that requiring proper tagging and adhering to the rest of tag team rules only adds more to the psychology of the match, because it makes the tag more difficult and then more meaningful when it's made.
Especially on the hot tags. And I got to bring that up, because I remember watching as a kid, and you'd always have the baby face. One member of the team's getting the absolute shit kicked out of them by the heel teams. They keep doing, again, they're not doing by the rules. I'd see heel guys all the time, and they'd do a high five to themselves in the air while the babyface partner on the apron is all distracted. And they're obviously not tagging, but they're just doing these things behind the referee's back and getting away with it, to the point where finally you'd get that what you think is the hot tag of the match, but the referee's eyes were turned away, didn't see it. The guy would be pushed back out. The heels would take over again. And you're just absolutely loathing the heels at this point now. You've really started to hate them because they couldn't do any more damage to your favorite guy inside that ring. And then that one little glimmer of hope comes forth. He kicks out of whatever move it is and springs forward towards his partner and claps that hand. And it really would make you pop in a tag team match when that hot tag happened like that.
Yeah, and that's the whole idea of building heat in a tag team match. It works good that way, and that the psychology is that the babyface doesn't have to power up and prevail. All he has to do is be able to reach his buddy, and that's also a theme that rings true with fans about that you have your friend is ready to back you up, and all you got to do is tag his hand, and he'll come in there and help you. It builds baby faces, it builds heat for the heels, and the master of the hot tag, of course, was Ricky Morton from the Rock and Roll Express. So those guys had it down to a science, and he was a pretty boy and a good-looking young guy and all that stuff, and the fans would be just wailing and crying and just wringing their hands while the heat was built on him. But you knew that he was going to get that hot tag at some point, and Robert Gibson would come in and clean house, and they had it down to such a perfect psychology in a match that the fans couldn't help but go insane.
Well, it's a good thing you brought up the Rock and Roll Express, because they were one team I wanted to mention here today. And then obviously their epic feuds that they had with the Notorious Midnight Express throughout the years and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great tag team they were as well, too. Obviously managed by the, should we say, often controversial individual himself, James E. Cornette, Jim Cornette, that most modern day fans absolutely cannot stand to listen to. But Papa Smokes and I, we don't care. We enjoy Jim Cornette and we enjoy the work he's done in the past. So whatever he chooses to say, fuck it. If you don't like it, don't listen.
Yeah. And however you feel about Cornette on a personal level, he's regarded throughout the business as a tag team wrestling genius. He took it to a science. He took it to an art and completely perfected it. And of course, when you're talking about the Midnight Express and the Rock and Roll Express, they worked together on this, and they had all the right parts to have the most classic matches. Man, those guys were drawing so much money. Those guys were getting paid $20,000 a month for having their feuds and their matches together and such. This is back in the 80s too. So you know that they were drawing a whole ton of money in the business all throughout the South, wherever they went. And that'll always be one of the most classic tag team wrestling feuds of all time.
But I remember even listening to the Jim Cornette podcast recently, and him talking about the contracts or the final written contracts that they ended up receiving after turning down an opportunity with the WWF. Yeah. He had promised all sorts of money that they could make with WWF, and then they were given guaranteed contracts. I believe it was in the vein of just shy of $200,000 per year or something. And we're talking about the 1980s. At this point in time, or even the late 70s when this happened. So, I mean, this was, equating to a lot of money at the time. And then even pushed further down the line to try to ask for $250,000, on their contract. So that just, the tip of the iceberg of what kind of drawing power that the teams like the Midnight Express had back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. And you got to remember, too, in the history of wrestling, like I would say, before the 80s, but in the 50s and 60s and 70s, pro wrestlers were some of the best paid quote unquote athletes of the entire sports world. And in the 50s and 60s, some of the top wrestlers like Buddy Rogers and Gorgeous George and Lou Thesz were making absolutely huge money, as much or more as some of the top guys in baseball, basketball, football. Now, with wrestling, you might be working a little bit more than those pro athletes in sports like I just mentioned, but it's not like that anymore. Obviously, the salaries from sports have skyrocketed into the realms of the absurd by this time, but pro wrestling pay has gone way down too since the 90s and the into the 2000s as well. So interesting that they don't make as much money as they used to now. The crowds aren't drawing as much these days, but used to be on par with pro sports.
So I want to talk quickly about another team, and reason being, because this ties back to a previous episode of Ring Respect Radio, talking about Terry and Dory Funk on the show here today. Yeah. And the reason I brought them up, Pop, as well as I mentioned to you earlier, is about the battles they had with the Briscoe brothers. We mentioned about the Briscoe brothers and Jerry Briscoe on a recent edition of Ring Respect. I'm going to put a tag up in the video here so you can go back and check out a little bit more on the Briscoes. But what are your fond memories of the Terry and Dory Funk as a tag team?
Well, the Funks were an awesome tag team because we all know Dory Funk Sr. was an absolute master of professional wrestling. Played both sides of the card in terms of heel and face, but was a technician like no other. And he taught his boys well. And I would say Dory Jr. was a little bit more like the old man, was a technician and knew all the psychology and knew all the technical wrestling. Terry did as well when he was younger too, was an excellent technical wrestler, and then was NWA champ back in the day for a short time as well, as a more clean-faced babyface kind of wrestler than he became. But the Funks, if you also think about it, are known for extreme brawling as well, and they brawled with many, many different kinds of tag teams, including the Briscoe brothers. That would be more of a scientific match they would have with them. But Terry and Dory were absolute holy terrors in Japan, too, fighting Giant Baba and some of his henchmen. Like we saw Terry's career, he went more the kind of hardcore or brawling sort of route eventually. But the Funks and the Briscoes will never be forgotten for tag teams, just for the teamwork and the skill and the psychology and just playing up success all the way through their careers.
And I think it would be wrong of us not to bring up the next tag team that I've got written down here, especially considering this is tag team wrestling and probably one of the most notable tag teams throughout the history of all tag team wrestling, and the Fabulous Freebirds.
Yeah, Freebirds, everything they touched turned to gold for a while there in down in Georgia, and Bad Street USA was Atlanta, Georgia, and that's where they were from. They also kind of pioneered that idea of having a three-man tag team with Roberts, Gordy, and Hayes, where their opponents would never really be sure until match time which two you might get. And that was always a difficult thing for their opponents too. But the Freebirds were just rock star type characters and arrogant heels, and they built a lot of heat. Their feud with the Von Erichs down in Texas was just tremendously memorable. You know, you couldn't get a better dichotomy between two teams of the kind of Jack Daniels drinking Southern rockin' Freebirds, and then the straight and narrow Von Erich boys drinking their milk and wrestling in bare feet and being popular, handsome kind of baby face guys, and really just the toast of Texas down there. And they were just printing money in the big Texas stadium there, and then there was three Von Erich boys that could do a match against all three Freebirds too. So it was just absolutely perfect. And Those guys will never be forgotten either. I was so sad when Terry Gordy passed away, but we still got Michael Hayes kicking around, and yeah, the Freebirds, huge team, huge, huge team.
And you talk about the opponents not knowing necessarily which two they were going to wrestle any given night when they were going against the Freebirds. Inevitably, this became known as a rule in wrestling called the Freebird Rule, and has actually been used more modernly with the team of the New Day, which I'll kind of go over in a little bit here. But yes, the Freebird Rule, for anybody listening unfamiliar, was because the Fabulous Freebirds had a team of three and you weren't sure which two you were going to get, it was allowed that any two combination from the group of three was allowed to wrestle. And therefore, moving forward in modern day, if you have the same situation, a group of three guys, tag team championships are among them, they can defend the titles, doesn't matter which two guys it is, as long as two guys from that group, known as the Freebird Rule.
And you could propagate some deception too and pretend one guy was injured and substitute another one in. And there were all kinds of shenanigans that went on with the Freebird Rule. But yeah, isn't it neat that they have a rule in wrestling that's still used named after them?
Sure is. Another team I wanted to mention here, the Wild Samoans. I mean, this very rich family heritage when it comes to these guys, and well-known inside the ring is the tag team combination.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we all know that the Samoans have done so great in wrestling. I don't mean to say just Samoans, but the Pacific Islanders in general, including Snuka and Tonga Kid and Haku and Umaga and all the other guys that were from that, not just from the Anoa'i family, but yeah, Afa and Sika, the Wild Samoans, were the first to start it, managed by Captain Lou Albano up in New York there for WWE, and they were multi-time tag teams, and they were among the first big tag teams of the 70s that to have a name, to be one of those tag teams that's like a matching pair, and they have a name and they look alike. You know what I mean here, Munson? The I think the first big team to do that was back in the 50s was from Australia, the Fabulous Kangaroos, the Heffernan brothers, and they had the same outfit. They had a name which included the two of them, and I've always kind of liked that in tag teams. I have a fondness for teams that have that look that's the same together, such as the Rock and Roll Express or the Midnight Express. They wear the same outfit and have a name where they're a collective. But I also, just on this topic for a second, have a fondness for mismatch teams as well, guys that don't look like they fit together, such as Andre and DiBiase or Owen Hart and Yokozuna, where one guy is strong in one area and the other guy makes up the slack in the other area is strong where the other guy is weak. I like both of those kinds of teams. But the Samoans, yeah, had a look that was similar, had that high-flying Tonga style, were eating the raw fish and all that stuff in their promos and grunting and screaming, a fantastic team that a lot of fans were not only hated but were afraid of too.
And you brought up Yokozuna. I would hate not to mention the fact that despite the way that he was billed back in the day, Yokozuna, also a Samoan.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we move into, say, early 90s, leading into some late 90s and more modern day tag teams, Pop Smokes, is there anybody that we missed here that we should probably talk about?
Well, yeah, there's one retro tag team that I'd like to bring up just for special excellence is and I think a lot of teams learned a lot from them. The teams like we were talking about, like the Midnight Express, heel teams that used the most of tag team psychology and rules to get a good match going, and that is Nick Bockwinkle and Ray Stevens. Both had been successful single stars before that. But when they came together in the AWA under and then got Bobby Heenan as their manager, but back then he was known as Bobby the Brilliant One Heenan. This I can't recommend enough watching their old stuff too. These guys had it down to a science, the sheer rule breaking they were doing and doing it behind the ref's back, doing it perfectly, frustrating the fans, frustrating their opponents. Fantastic stuff. WWE put out a DVD some years ago of AWA and some of its great matches. There's a Bockwinkel and Stevens match on there, the very one where they introduce Heenan as their manager. It's against Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel. This match is a textbook for a heel tag team on how to just build heat, how to just be an absolute cheap, cheating, rule-breaking team. Sheer genius, in my opinion, and any discussion of tag teams in the past of pro wrestling would be empty without mentioning Bockwinkel and Stevens, in my opinion.
And you know what? I just, as we were talking about this too, something else came to mind, and I know we've not mentioned them recently on the show, but we did watch, do a watch along during Ring Respect Retro back in the day when you introduced me to the Sheep Herders, Papa Smokes,
yeah.
And I can't go without mentioning how much I enjoyed watching yeah. what the Sheep Herders were. For the modern fans, the Bushwhackers are what you might know them as. That's what I knew of them growing up, and I wouldn't ever classify the Bushwhackers as a team to mention when you're talking about the greats of all time.
Yeah.
But then when you look back on the Sheepherders' work, now you start to have them in the conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And just like so many WWE wrestlers in the 80s, it was where you could go if you were an established star elsewhere in the country and Vince decided to pick you up. You could go there and wrestle your last couple of years of your career, probably with some kind of a gimmick attached to you, but you'd be making the big money finally. We saw so many wrestlers do that, including Ric Flair and Harley Race and Junkyard Dog and a whole bunch of guys like that. It was sad for me to think that people know them from that last dying days of their careers there, and that's what they're remembered for. But really, these guys went because You could go out on you could finish your career on a big splash instead of a small one, right? On the big stage, on TV, getting paid the big money and such. And that's clearly what happened to the Sheepherders. But as we watched some of their matches in the past months, and you've seen that they're just fearsome villains, complete rule breakers, complete assholes to everybody involved in their segments, and someone that I watched as a little kid, what was afraid of and everything as a little kid. And I'll always love the Sheepherders a lot. But Bushwhackers, you know, became a mid-card or lower-end card tag team in the WWE, a comedy spot and a little spot for the kids to have a laugh and such like that. And that's fine. And they made some money at the end of their careers, and people remember who they are too, which is always a good thing. But always a bit sad for me at times like that to see the past glories kind of gone.
And I did get to meet the Bushwhackers as a kid. Great experience. I mean, great guys. They were a lot of fun. I mean, I was, again, I'm talking like, you know, I'm 5-6 years old at this time. So, I mean, not only meeting yeah. the Bushwhackers at the time, but watching them on TV. It was fun for me as a kid because I was a kid. That was the type of entertainment I was exposed to.
Well, be glad they were the Bushwhackers when you met them when you were 6, not the Sheepherders, because that experience might have gone a lot differently.
Definitely so. So we're going to move forward. I wanted to actually one other team that maybe doesn't land quite in the modern times, but I'm going to bring them up a little bit before as we try to ease into some more modern teams. The British Bulldogs, always a classic. They're all obviously the other end of the spectrum to the Sheepherders. These were the clean cut baby faces, really putting on a really technical match inside that ring, especially the stuff the Dynamite Kid brought to the table a lot of the time. Great tag team of the past.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, I think that was a case of one of those things, too, where both Dynamite and Davey Boy started their training in England, which is a little bit different style than we do over here. It's a little stiffer. It's a little closer to real grappling, I think. But both Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith, once they came to North America, came to Calgary, where they could really get their training amped up in Stu Hart's dungeon and with all the Hart boys and such. So, and really, Stampede had such a great, great thing going for a long time there. And they had they not only put on great shows, but all the guys they trained out there were solid, solid professional wrestlers. And you know, Dynamite and Davey had already started, were already kind of journeyman wrestlers at that point. But when they came together in Stampede, they just, they added on to that great training they had already had with more and more great training. And then that's why they turned out to be such a strong tag team, in my opinion. And, you know, it's kind of funny. You called them the clean cut, babyface team and all that too, but, it's fun. That's how they wrestled in the ring. But, to know some of the behind the scenes stuff, they were not popular because Dynamite was a pretty mean guy and a real mean ribber. And I won't go into detail about some of the ribs he pulled on other wrestlers in the back, but some of that was pretty mean shit, man, and would probably start a fight, except that Dynamite was a pretty tough guy, too, and was not scared of anyone. But also on Dynamite's suggestion, watch some of those matches from the 80s, too, when they're in there with preliminary talent. They're pretty stiff, man. They treat the guys real rough, and lots of those... I like to call them preliminary talents, didn't want that assignment. Same thing with Road Warriors in the old days. They always said some of the guys would come in and see their name on the list in the back against Road Warriors and just pick up their bag and walk right out because you're in for a rough night. Same thing with the British Bulldogs. They were not gentle in there.
And you mentioned them training with the Hart family, which brings me to another team we're going to mention, and that is the Hart Foundation. And we could go on to different variations of the Hart Foundation later on. You had Owen and Davey Boy. At times you had, you know, Owen and Brett teaming up. But I'm talking about the original Hart Foundation. We're talking about Jim the Anvil Neidhart, Brett the Hitman Hart, the ones that really kind of conquered the WWF in the late 80s into the early 90s there.
Yeah. An unforgettable team as well. That was one of the teams also that I thought, along with the British Bulldogs, it was kind of interesting. Even once they got to WWF, they were still allowed to, presumably they pitched it to Vince where, you know, in the case of the Hart Foundation, Brett might have said, well, I got this guy that I worked with in Calgary. He's my brother-in-law. We know each other inside and out. We should be a tag team. Probably the same thing with Davey Boy and Dynamite Kid, and were allowed to make their own team like that. Or I presume they did anyway. I don't know that for a fact, but Vince knew that those Calgary guys knew what they were talking about, and it's kind of like the same thing with Bret Hart's defense of the Intercontinental Championship at SummerSlam at Wembley when... Mr. Perfect was unable to make his date for that, and it was the day before the match or the day of the match, and they didn't have an opponent for him, and Brett just said, well, why don't you make it Davey? I've worked with him a million times, like we could throw together a good match. And well, yeah, but Davey's a babyface as well, and well, it's Wembley, London, England is his hometown, like, you know, I'll heal it up a little bit, and Davey Boy will be the hometown hero. So again, the Vince trusted those Calgary guys to a certain extent that they had worked so much together in the past and were so well trained that they could always put on a good show. And I think that was true of Hart Foundation and British Bulldogs.
Very much so. And I mean, a lot of that can be, you know, not only just the Calgary guys, but I mean, Brett, just a true legend of the ring. I mean, I've said it before, how much of a fan I am of Brett the Hitman Hart's work throughout the years, and that's never going to change for me. So, but we're going to talk about a few more modern teams that came along. I remember, you know, some of my early memories of tag team wrestling being with guys from the Steiner Brothers. I remember Scott and Rick Steiner coming in, having that real clean cut. This is the, you know, the NCAA, like, professional wrestling guys that had just been fresh out of the universities. Even though I know now that wasn't quite the case, I know that Rick Steiner himself actually started off a little bit before Scotty even got into it and stuff like that. But I do remember the team of the Steiner brothers and, you know, some very memorable moves and matches that those guys would be able to put on inside the ring, and got me a little bit more excited about tag team wrestling in the aspect of WWF wrestling back in the early 90s.
Yeah, no question. The Steiners will be remembered as one of the greater teams in professional wrestling history. They had that... that collegiate background that really does make a pro wrestler seem more believable when he's got a good sports background behind him. They were both brothers that were All-American at University of Michigan, and they were Wolverines on the wrestling team there. And they were another team that came out pretty stiff too. They were not out there to hurt anybody or anything like that, but they were such huge, strong guys that there wasn't much you could do about it. If they were going to suplex you across the ring onto your head, that's what you were going to do then. And they won everything there is to win. And again, that's another team that really never took off in WWE. I'm not sure if it was because of the booking or something like that, but I think they could have been popular anywhere if they were used properly, for sure.
Definitely. So, and then I'll switch gears a little bit. I know I've talked to you a bit about it before. I didn't necessarily watch WCW quite off the hop of my pro wrestling watching, and I learned about them kind of as a lot of guys from WWF were jumping ship. And I remember when I turned over to there, and you'd look at a lot of it, and a lot of it was just rehashed WWF guys and stuff like that. But there was always some people that stood out. And for me, the one tag team that really stood out over in WCW that I'm always going to remember from that era that I enjoyed watching, and I would actually tune into any of the matches they had back then, it Harlem Heat. I really enjoyed Harlem Heat back in the 90s.
Yeah. I also did. I didn't know who Stevie Ray was so much. I knew who Booker T was, because he had done some stuff before that. But what a great team too. And there's another one where they decided to have a look where they matched up. They wore the same trunks. They looked real cool. They were both huge. They had the nice flames and everything on their outfit. And then with an excellent manager like Sherry Martel, they really struck gold with that tag team in WCW. Those guys probably weren't even all that experienced of a team, but they got a good push, and the boys made the best of it. And yeah, when you talk about 90s WCW, Harlem Heat was, excuse me, Harlem Heat was the team to beat at that time. And numerous runs as champion, a bunch of good feuds, good manager, and they'll be remembered for a long time.
Definitely. So definitely one of the standouts there. I'm going to jump over to kind of like as we hit towards the late 90s here, Papa Smokes. This is about when I was in my teenage years and hitting into my early adulthood. Now, we're talking about Attitude Era Wrestling. And I'm going to particularly talk about three teams and stuff. And we talked about this before we went on the air here. And I'm going to mention them. Individually, these teams all had, in my opinion, some great matches. Some other ones where it's like it became too much of the hardcore stuff over and over again. But let's eliminate all the talk of the hardcore stuff and our thoughts on that. The Hardy Boys, Edge and Christian, and Dudley Boys, I feel, were three teams that definitely defined tag team wrestling towards the later 90s, early 2000s in professional wrestling.
Yeah, very much so. I would say even especially the Dudleys were so successful. They had a great presentation. They kind of had the Hanson Brothers hockey kind of thing going on, and the fans loved them. I think Bully and Bubba and Devon are just all great characters. Bubba or Bully Ray, kind of the leader of the team, a little bit more outspoken. But Devon, also great stuff. They won every title there was to be won. I always liked the way they put celebrities or legends through tables and all that. And they'll be remembered as one of the great ones. And then this was just another era of tag team wrestling, after the after some of the other great teams we talked about, like Harlem Heat and Rock and Roll Express, after they were done in the 90s and such, we had to get some new ones in. There we had Edge and Christian, a couple of good Canadian boys that came up to WWE and got signed by Jim Ross and Cornette. And same thing with the Hardy Boys too. They didn't have a developmental program per se back then, so they relied on WWE relied on some of their the knowledge of their wrestling employees there and the people that had watched tapes, you know, back then, even before the internet was a huge thing where you could watch everything. They needed guys like Jim Ross, Cornette, and Pritchard and Pat Patterson, who had watched tons of this stuff and knew how to scout talent like that too. And some of those guys they brought in, the Hardy Boys, gave them a deal. You know, they weren't going to get signed at first because they weren't big enough. And you know how Vince likes his big guys, but, you know, it ended up happening and look what happened. Look what they did with their chance, right? Like, they're one of the teams that will also never be forgotten in the history of wrestling. And same with Edge and Christian too. Both had, extremely, good singles runs after that too, but as a tag team, you know, those ladder matches and the TLC matches and stuff with some of the teams we've just been talking about are WWE classics. And you know that wrestlers today that were young when that stuff was coming out look to that and to you know, develop their style and some of their tricks. And yeah, they'll be watched for 50 years after this.
So let's mention it. We're talking about more modern teams. I'm going to talk about a couple of modern day WWE teams, and then we're going to go on to talk about a couple from MLW and finish up with a little bit of a discussion at FTR. So I know a lot of people are really high on the team of the New Day, and I know you're familiar with the guys a bit there too, Papa Smokes, but watching more modern wrestling, the New Day is one of these ones that the fabulous Freebird rule was brought back for with these three guys, Xavier Woods, Kofi Kingston, Big E Langston, and everything like that. This team has actually been around for quite a while now at this point with, I believe now officially as of the other night, now 7 tag team title runs, one of which actually is now officially the longest tag team title run in WWE history, having just edged out Demolition, I believe, for that run as the tag team champions. It's really hard to document it now with there being 2 different tag titles, 2 different shows within WWE. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a WWE championship in that tag team vein. So therefore it classifies under the same. They had a lot of great feuds. And to me, a lot of those great feuds really all came back down to the Usos. And the Usos, to me, probably one of the best modern day tag teams. I like the work of these guys, especially once they made their heel turn. I think that, you know, obviously it's in their blood being from the Samoan family that they're from and everything like that. But the work of the Usos inside that ring, especially when they got in there with the New Day and got a little bit innovative as well, too. When they got in there and started doing the Hell in a Cell match that they had between the Usos and the New Day, there was some innovations there, I believe, where the Usos actually pinned Xavier Woods pinned him to the side of the cell using the kendo sticks or whatever. So utilizing some of this stuff that we joke about, like, why do they have kendo sticks there in the first place? But if you're going to have them there, utilize them in a way that makes it interesting. They did that night and it was quite entertaining. I still look upon that as, you know, a fond time for modern wrestling in terms of the tag division, and thought, you know, maybe there was an opportunity that we're going to see a real revival and a breath of fresh air in tag team wrestling. Unfortunately, just like all modern wrestling, as soon as something starts to get good, they shit all over it and put it back down. Now they've gone ahead. They've split the New Day. The tag titles are with Kofi and Xavier, but Big E staying on another show. Just a big pile of garbage mess like it usually is. It's kind of unfortunate because being a fan of tag wrestling, I would have loved to have seen maybe more of that. I know some people get tired of seeing, okay, you know, New Day and Usos over and over again. But, I mean, there's something to be said there with those boys. They work well together in the ring. There's a reason that they stood out well together. And that's what I'm going to bring there. 7 runs is nothing to be ashamed of for the New Day. I mean, great for them. It was a great place on the card and really helped, in my opinion, elevate those guys. I mean, we know Kofi was around for a while, had, you know, a decent name behind him as a mid-card to upper mid-card talent. Xavier Woods and Big E almost had nothing going for them at the time. Nobody knew them. Nobody really had any reason to get behind them. And these guys, they were put together. They became friends, told to come up with something. They came up with, it's goofy at times. Don't get me wrong. A lot of the gimmick is very silly, but at the heart of it, I can see three guys having a good time that are good friends, and they went out there. And when it came down to the actual ring work, they got the job done. They utilized the three-person rule quite well at times, often utilizing that thing where, you know, when they were heels, they would pretend like one guy was injured and utilize that just like the Freebirds used to back in the day. I mean, so kudos in terms of the modern day, the New Day, Usos, two standouts, in my opinion, from WWE.
Yeah, that's interesting. I honestly haven't watched much of the New Day's stuff. Some of the comedy gimmickry was kind of a bit too much for me. It seemed like all trombones and pancakes for a while there. But the Usos, I was going to bring up a point about them. We talked in the past about the Guerrero brothers, another good tag team we could bring up. Not brothers, I guess. They were nephew and uncle, but... just like someone from those wrestling families, I've read that Eddie and Chavo Jr. talked about having a wrestling ring in their yard ever since they can ever remember. And I'm going to imagine that it was the same thing for the young Uso brothers, coming from that Samoan heritage and so many other family members being in the wrestling biz. That I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that they were kids that grew up with a ring that they could use at any time and with a whole bunch of relatives that they could ask questions to at any time, too. And, I mean, when you're that young of a kid and you have that much access to a ring and other experienced and famous wrestlers that you can talk to, get trained by, get advice from, get ideas from. I mean, it's almost a foregone conclusion that you're going to end up as a big popular wrestler at some point. And like, watch the Usos match. They look like they're so comfortable in the ring, and they've got all the tag team psychology down. And I've been impressed by a few of their matches as well. So there are teams that are continuing the excellent days of the Crockett, Jim Crockett Promotions tag team in the 80s and that. And even though WWE isn't valuing tag team wrestling all that much these days, putting it on the preliminary and mid-card areas and never any tag team main events, you still have good lifelong wrestlers like the Uso brothers that came up in the biz and had all the tools to make it big in WWE.
Definitely so. So enough about WWE though. Let's talk about a few things outside the WWE and outside the big guys for a little bit. Well, I mean, we'll end on one of the big guys here, but let's talk a little bit about one of our favorites. We're talking about MLW, and let's maybe bring up the some of the teams over there, in particular the Von Erichs, the MLW tag champs, as we head towards the hashtag the restart of MLW coming up here.
Yeah, well, speaking of young guys that would have grown up in the wrestling family and in the business, Ross and Marshall Von Erich being the sons of Kevin Von Erich, I mean, the fact that they're young and wrestlers now kind of suggests that they probably wanted to be that their whole lives. And with the famous wrestler dad from that famous family in Texas, Von Erich said they would have just been earmarked for greatness probably from an early age. And they're still kind of learning. Like they still have their moments where they look a little bit green, even on MLW, but they're working on it. The boy, they're big, they're handsome, they look great. And they're going to be a successful tag team in the world of professional wrestling, probably as long as they want to, especially having that last name.
And, you know, a lot of great things going on over there at MLW. So a great opportunity for them to flourish with some other great teams there and a lot of great teams that have been built. We were talking before the show went on the air about also the Dynasty over there as well, too, that happened in MLW. We're talking about Pillman Jr. and Davey Boy Smith Jr., who also made a great team and also have that lineage of, parents that were involved working together, because we know that the late Brian Pillman and the late Davey Boy Smith, also part of the Hart Foundation that took part in around the Attitude Era of the late 1990s there for the WWF, So another great pairing that's working on becoming, future stars in the business.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've got that name to go back on too. And then there's another tag team in MLW that I'm really enjoying these days. And that's Alexander Hammerstone and Richard Holiday. And as a heel tag team, they're just ripping it up over there. They've got their faction kind of thing. They had a couple of other members, one of which was MJF, who is obviously busy right now in AEW. They had another guy, too, that didn't really work out. So right now their faction is just the two of them, and Hammerstone holds that openweight championship, but him and Richard Holiday doing lots of tag team action together. And like we've said before, MLW really one of the best promotions going at this time. I think they have integrity with their business model and with their booking. And Court Bauer has just gone out of his way to get different kinds of wrestlers from different parts of the world that wrestle different styles, including Lucha. And he's trying to open up throughout Europe and even some parts of Africa and all that. And yeah, it just brings a flavor to the show that is just excellent. And they've got all kinds of Lucha tag teams going on there too, with L.A. Park and El Hijo de Park, his son, I guess, and all kinds of Lucha action going on, and a strong tag team division. I can't wait to see more of it in the future.
Looking forward to it. And you can check that up. That's, we're probably about a month away, or just over a month away from MLW's hashtag The Restart. So look forward to that. Go check them out once they do get up and running, and check out some of the old material from them as well too. You won't be disappointed. We're going to end the show on a tag team here today, Papa Smokes, because there is a bit to talk about these guys. Both in the sense that you and I both have enjoyed work of theirs, and also have seen a decline, not necessarily that is of their fault, but we mentioned about MJF and AEW. So let's get on the top of AEW and FTR, The Revival, Cash and Dax, whatever name we want to go by. What a great team these guys are and have the potential to be when given the right teams to work with. When they came up through NXT, they made a mark instantly. Some great classics there that they had with Jordan and Gable at the time, known as American Alpha. I mean, some absolute just barn burner matches that they had with the two of those guys. And then some of the ones that they had with DIY as well, too. And many regard the match in Toronto with DIY and FTR as being one of the better tag team matches, especially in modern wrestling. But if not, in question for one of the better tag team matches of all time. Couldn't agree more. It's an absolute classic, great match, and Dax and Cash really know how to put on a show. The part that really grinds me a lot too is they were so upset with the way they were being treated in WWE, and I get that. But then they leave to go to AEW, and this had to have, in my opinion, been one of the biggest mistakes they could make in terms of being a tag team, because the tag team division in AEW, in my opinion, is not up to par with what tag team wrestling should be. It's no better a situation than what's going on in the WWE. And they have been left with, in my opinion, inferior opponents, nobody really to book them strongly against, and nobody that can give them the type of classic match that they got out of guys like DIY and American Alpha over in the WWE.
Yeah, I got to agree with you there, Monson. I was happy for them and that they, after all the contract struggles in the WWE, that they finally did get their release and that they would be free to do what they wanted and work with who they wanted. And then I was a little bit surprised that they signed with AEW, because it didn't seem like that natural of a fit, because as we've talked about FTR, just as our whole topic is today, FTR is our students of classic 80s, a prime time, a golden era tag team wrestling of, like we said, Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express, Arn and Tully, the Four Horsemen, all those classic tag teams of the 80s. You see that influence in FTR's style. But what they've done in joining AEW is joining a company where nobody else works like that. Excuse me, AEW has, what, 20, 25 tag teams, and none of them work like a classic team. They all are very gimmick heavy. They all work the very, very modern style, and that's unlike Dax and Cash, the way they revere the great historians and the great performers of the past. Yeah, like you say, they have no one really to work with in this company that has a similar style to them. And I watched their debut in AEW in the first few matches they had there, and I was kind of disappointed because their booking in AEW is so confusing all the time. They're trying to go the route of not having clearly defined heels and faces, but it takes away a lot of the heat from the match when you don't have that. You can argue that the modern wrestling fan is beyond the archetype of having one villain and one face team against each other, and modern fans like to say, well, we don't need that anymore, and it's too simple, and it's not needed anymore. But I kind of have to disagree with that because the only way that you really get the heat in professional wrestling is one tag team is acting like complete assholes and cheating the whole time. Therefore, the fans are going to cheer for the team that's keeping it straight. And when you have all these, since Stone Cold Steve Austin, the ultimate heel that you loved to hate and became so popular, there's many, many wrestlers now that want to ride that razor's edge between being hated and being loved. And you can't do that. Like only once a generation will somebody come along that can do that, that is so over and so good at his craft that he can walk the line between heel and face. And I don't think that most of these wrestlers nowadays can do that or should try to do that. So right off the bat, I was disappointed by FTR's booking. They stomped their way to the championships pretty quickly, which I think was a good idea for AEW to do. But since then, it's looked like they've struggled without quality opposition. And I mean, even the team they won the belts from, Omega and Page, was kind of a pasted together team that they're also quite different in the way they wrestle, Omega and Page, and really not a memorable tag team. They needed the champs right off the bat. And since Omega was doing the booking of the tag team division, of course he's going to put himself in there with some gold on. And I just think it's been kind of a shit show, to be perfectly honest. And I love that FTR is bringing their real brand of wrestling there, but they look like they're struggling without proper opposition. And we'll just have to see what happens in the future, I guess.
Hopefully things pick up for them over there, or better yet, if they would have done what I was hoping for in the first place, I would have loved to have seen FTR go perfect their craft around the world, go over to places like Japan, go over to the UK and hop on with some of the companies out there, even come spend some time here in good old Canada and stuff like that. I think we really could have seen a lot of utilization for FTR throughout the independents over in New Japan and some of the bigger places in the UK. And then also maybe being able to do some spots with the NWA and MLW. I mean, a lot of great teams that you would have there. I mean, God forbid, the NWA would have been an absolute perfect fit for the style of FTR.
But I think just in today's modern era of wrestling, or really any era of wrestling, you only get that window where you're a big superstar on a limited basis. It's not going to last forever. And I can see why they wanted to go to a company that has a national TV show where you can get noticed and get your name out there and make some money while you're still physically able to and all that. I'm quite sure that Cash and Dax would love to go and rumble with some of the teams in NWA or MLW, but I think they have to be current. They have to be up there with the money makers in the game and the big movers and shakers, and that's what they did with the move to AEW.
Well, hopefully, maybe things will get better in the near future. I don't want to sit here and make it seem like we're going to constantly rag on AEW or AEW's booking. Again, we both are on the same page that I think we would love to see AEW just take what they're doing and take away the goofiness and go for that seriousness they always talked about, because we do need an alternative to what we get from the big guys over in the WWE. It would be nice to have something treated more like the old classic sports wrestling show that you used to get in the past, while, you know, giving it a modern spin. Not every match has to be booked 50-50. Not every guy has to be pushed to the, you know, to the friggin' moon and stuff like that. You got guys that are there. They're preliminary guys. That's the way they should be. FTR should be treated like gold, but given, you know, some good opponents to work there with, and give them people a reason to hate these guys the way that they should. I mean, these guys were classic in WWE for some of those spots where it's like, you know, they just would do those classic dirty heel tricks behind the referee's back that, you know, it would really grind your gears. You're like, man, fuck these guys. But at the same time, you're rooting for them because this works. And it proved that it worked over and over again. You know what? FTR, great tag team. Hope nothing but for the best for them. And hopefully, hey, let's, you know, maybe in a year's time, we'll be sitting here talking about the excitement of an AEW show for the first time ever. You know, hopefully change our minds, AEW. Please do, because we need an alternative to what we're watching on TV on a regular basis these days. That said, though, Papa Smokes, I mean, this is one of our longest-running episodes of Ring Respect Radio we've had in a long time, and I think we could probably go on talking all night about tag team wrestling and the history of it. This has been probably one of my most favorite episodes of this show that we have done so far. Continues to only get better, and hopefully you, the fans, enjoyed it as well. If you did enjoy the show, let us know in the comments below. Make sure to like and subscribe right here on Ring Respect Radio, and as said before, check us out on all of Backbreaker Media's cast as well, including Podbean and YouTube there. From Pop Smokes and I both, we want to thank you again for spending time listening to us here today, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you in the near future. Have a good night.